The Monsters That Made Us is brought to you by the Cage Club Podcast Network. For all things movies, music, media, monsters, and more, head on over to cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me. Today we're heading back to the year 1946, where adventurers and former wartime spies Rick and Evie O'Connell find themselves whiling away the hours in their retirement when they are once again called back into service by the British government, this time to return a priceless gemstone known as the Eye of Shangri-La back to China. Meanwhile, their son Alex has just discovered the tomb of the legendary Dragon Emperor, an evil warlord who founded China's Qin Dynasty, built the Great Wall over the bodies of his enemies, and commanded all five of the Wuxing elements. But a rogue Chinese general has plans to resurrect the Dragon Emperor, believing he can lead the country through the post-war chaos and civil war. And it's up to Rick, Evie, Alex, Jonathan, and a mysterious young woman who may or may not be centuries old to race through the streets of Shanghai, trek the Himalaya Mountains, and stop the Dragon Emperor and his terracotta army from taking over the world. Brush up on your Sanskrit and join us for more heart-stopping adventure as we discuss The Mummy, Tomb of the Dragon Emperor.
To a new world of gods and monsters.
Listen to them. Children of the night.
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
You're crazy to know who I am, aren't you? I'll show you who I am and what I am!
You're insane. I tell you, I killed a wolf, a plain, ordinary wolf.
By studying these and other species, we add to our knowledge of how life evolved, how it adapted itself to this world.
He went for a little walk. He could have seen his face.
Welcome to the Return of the Monsters That Made Us, the podcast where we celebrate the spooktacular characters and films in the Universal Studios classic monster series. Today we'll be discussing The Mummy, Tomb of the Dragon Emperor. I'm the Invisible Dan Colon, and joining me as always is my co-host, who may also possibly be hundreds of years old, Monster Mike Manzi.
Hey Dan, I'm racing a clayface airbender to Shangri-La. Mummies, dragons, and yetis, oh my!
Yeah, man, this thing has everything. This is the third and final installment of the O'Connell's Mummy Adventures.
The O'Connell Saga. I love it.
We've talked about this before, that this mummy trilogy like kind of puts the O'Connells at the center of it as opposed to the mummy, right? Which I think is a pretty cool thing to do, different from the original mummy movies.
Yeah, interesting conceit, right? That they are the connective tissue. I like that.
So let's do like a quick recap of everything we've done kind of up to this point, starting in 1999, when Universal kind of dug up their old monsters again and released The Mummy. It was a smash hit. It made $1 zillion. In 2001, they gave writer, director, producer Stephen Sommers carte blanche to do it all again, bigger and better than before. And then they released The Mummy Returns, which introduces a new monster and also does really well at the box office. And so the following year, 2002, they give that new monster his own movie, The Scorpion King. By 2004, Universal has decided monsters are in again and plan to launch an entire universe of films and TV shows around them, beginning with Van Helsing. But the problem is Van Helsing flops horribly, and that results in all of those plans being canceled immediately. But they know people love The Mummy, so here we are now in 2008 with a new mummy movie. The framework is familiar. A cursed, power-hungry mummy is resurrected, and the O'Connells are once again relying on magic books and weapons to stop him from taking over the world with his undead army. But this time, instead of Egypt, the entire thing takes place in China. We trade in the old mummy wrappings for terracotta. We trade in the pyramids for a great wall. A magic spear is now a dagger. And instead of a book of the dead, we've got the Oracle Bones. But the O'Connells are parents now, and their son Alex is now a young adventurer just like they were. So naturally that factors into this one as well. So there's a lot of familiar stuff here, a little bit of new stuff, specifically the setting. But Mike, what are your thoughts on Tomb of the Dragon Emperor? And if you'll pardon the expression, is the third time a charm?
Well, perhaps. Okay, so, apparently I've seen this movie before. An old Letterboxd review came up that I'm going to read that I don't feel this way right now. I don't feel this way anymore. However, I had thought I'd never seen this movie in its entirety, and apparently I have. And this is, unfortunately, the second time I've seen it, not the third time I've seen it. But I think the next time I see it, I might like it even more, just to sort of, show my hand a little bit. But if I may, here's what I had to say on June 8th, 2017. Awful. And yet one star for Jet Li throwing his ceramic face at someone. Jet Li transforming into a three-headed cartoon dragon and the Yeti that punts a soldier like a field goal then makes the sign with his arms. Like, how the hell does a Yeti know the rules of football in 1940s China? What the hell does China have to do with the mummy? What is life at this point? One star.
So I almost brought up that Letterboxd review, but I figured I would let you either decide to mention it or not.
Yeah. I mean, look, I don't feel that way now. I mean, look, I am a different person than I was in 2017. I think of movies a little different. I definitely think of this type of movie differently after all of the monster podcasting we've done over the years. And I have to say now, it's all right. Look, okay, like I'm with this movie most of the way. If I feel like it falls apart at the end, like most movies this size, okay, yep. But still is able to wrap it up well enough. I like where it tries to go. I like what it does successfully. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff to like here. Look, I would rewatch this before Van Helsing. I'd probably rewatch this before Mummy Returns, to be honest, just because that is so similar to the original. Like that has too much of the same stuff. Like at least this might replay even certain sequences, you know, like Rick is going to get stabbed and brought back to life instead of Evelyn in this one. They're going to replay exact same beats. I like the look. I like the new location. I like the idea that there's multiple meanings to what makes a mummy, depending on the culture. You know, I enjoyed it this time around. Hold on real quick. Let's see what I gave it on Letterboxd recently. I know I didn't write a review because I didn't want to spoil the podcast, but The Mummy Tomb of the Dragon Emperor, 2.5 stars.
Not bad. This was my first time with this one. Somehow I had managed to never see Tomb of the Dragon Emperor until now. So I went in completely cold, not really knowing what to expect. I mean, I knew the cast was great. I'm much more familiar with this cast now from like other things that I've been watching the past couple of years. You know, I've gotten more into martial arts movies in the past few years. This one, yeah, I kind of feel like I need to put a little disclaimer on this, similar to you. You know, like I don't dislike this movie, but I think what's disappointing about it is that so much of it feels by the numbers. So much of it feels like they kind of followed the same formula from the previous movies and just put it in a new country. And they've got a new mummy who looks different, but you know, he kind of feels very similar to the previous mummy in the abilities that he had. And, you know, we're going to get into it, but he could have been a lot more like Imhotep. So I'm glad that they were able to sort of trim a lot of that out. But at the end of the day, I feel like, okay, they're going to kind of do a by the numbers O'Connell mummy movie, but they've got Jet Li and they've got Michelle Yeoh, who were pretty big international stars by this point. And they don't really, in my opinion, use them to maximum effect. I feel like Jet Li kind of isn't given a whole lot to do. And you know, he's CG for most of the movie. I'm pretty sure he did all of the motion capture himself. You know, aside from the opening prologue and then the battle at the end, that's kind of it. And then to have Jet Li and Michelle Yeoh at the end fighting each other, that could have been so amazing. And I feel like it dropped the ball a little bit in that. I don't mind that the movie recycles a lot of the framework of previous mummy movies. And, you know, you kind of get the same kinds of things from the Rick and Evie relationship and what we've learned about their relationship with Alex. Like, that, all that makes sense and feels good and familiar. But, like, their opportunity to really knock this one out of the park was with the casting of, you know, their Asian actors. And, like, I just feel like the film doesn't really do enough with them.
I definitely agree. It's sort of an issue I had with Michelle Yeoh and Shang-Chi as well, where it's like she just kind of shows up at the end to train and battle. I had a theory about why this was even based in China. You know, at the time, I feel like there was a big push by like Hollywood and that market to kind of commingle really well. They even shot like exclusive scenes for Iron Man 3 for Chinese audiences. And, you know, they would make special edits of movies of Pirates of the Caribbean, whatever. Like, I just know that there was a big push to try and gain that international box office. So I wonder if that was a reason to bring it there this time around. Now, as far as like Jet Li and Michelle Yeoh, I've been watching them battle each other in like Kung Fu movies for years. Yeah. So like, this was going to be such a thrill to see them throw down. I do wish that they are in it more and they had more to do, but I was actually really impressed that they're even here and doing this in the first place. And like, that was a lot of fun. Just, you know, enjoy what they're here for. But yeah, I definitely agree. Like, even Michelle Yeoh's character, they have a character that plays her daughter, like it almost feels like the same character, just make it that character. Those kinds of situations kind of pop up again in this type of movie. I agree that it's very formulaic. You know what it has that a lot of movies don't is like, it just has a certain charm. Like I'm so endeared to the O'Connells at this point that I was really just like going to be down for the adventure, whatever it was going to be this time.
In a way, it does feel a little bit like an old sweater or like a warm blanket. There is something comfortable about how formulaic this one is, right? You kind of know what to expect. You know, you're going to get Rick and Evie, and Jonathan is just going to be Jonathan, which is always a treat to watch. But I don't know. There's something about this one, like considering the cast and the relocation, I wanted something really spectacular out of it. And I feel like it just doesn't quite deliver in the ways that it should deliver. Again, not to harp on it, but to have these incredible actors in Jet Li and Michelle Yeoh and then not deliver on that. That should be amazing. But again, like you said, they fought each other lots of times in Hong Kong action movies.
I think it just suffers from what a lot of things did or do naturally. It's just like it goes overboard, like they all do. And at times it's hard to prevent that, right? And I think this does a better job of controlling itself than a lot of movies do. You know, if they had pulled back a little on some of the effects, maybe even like chop that whole third act and have it take place in the snowy mountains or something. But like there's actually a really fun, awesome movie that like works perfectly in here. I just think that there's too much other stuff going on too. It's bloated in that sense. I feel like more works in this than I was expecting.
You know, just to end on something positive here, I do think that the pacing here is a dramatic improvement over The Mummy Returns. You know, remember we were kind of exhausted at the end of that movie. This one is paced much better. I still wish we kind of knew more about the Dragon Emperor. It kind of follows the pacing of that original movie. It's not quite an hour of setup and then an hour of, okay, we've got a mummy, but it's similar to that, which I think allows the characters to breathe a little more. We get more O'Connell stuff, if that's your thing. And I do think that the special effects here are incredible. Also a dramatic improvement over The Mummy Returns. There's a lot of really cool stuff with the terracotta soldiers, and then the emperor himself kind of goes in and out of terracotta, like as he breaks apart and then reforms. He turns into a three-headed dragon by the end, and like that looked really good. So I do want to give this one props for having really solid effects work.
It's all better than the King Scorpion Monster.
Yes.
Right. So already we've reached above that bar.
On the whole, I think that it's perfectly fine. I think I just want a little bit more from it.
I think we could get that by having less. You know, I think that was where I was trying to go.
Okay. So let's get into it here. This one went through quite a bit of pre-production and all kinds of drama here. So we got our producers, Stephen Summers, Bob Doucet, Sean Daniel, and James Jax, the usual suspects for these mummy movies. In 2001, after the release of The Mummy Returns, Stephen Summers did express interest in a third mummy film, saying, quote, "There's a demand for it, but most of the gang would only be up for it again if we could find a way to make it bigger and better." Typical Stephen Summers. By 2004, during the release of Van Helsing, he had changed his tune somewhat, doubting having the energy for another mummy film, although he did entertain a script by screenwriting partners Alfred Goff and Miles Millar, who were ultimately credited with the screenplay. Now, a little bit about them. Before Tomb of the Dragon Emperor, Goff and Millar became a writing team while studying at the University of Southern California. And as students, they sold their first script to New Line Cinema for $400,000. It was called Mango, and it was a buddy cop story about a cop who was allergic to animals and was paired with an orangutan.
Oh, come on.
Classic.
They never made that movie?
It never got made, but it did help launch their careers in Hollywood. They went on to create Smallville for television, and they developed the stories for Lethal Weapon 4 and Spider-Man 2.
Oh, okay. Spider-Man 2 is sometimes considered the best superhero movie.
For a long time, yeah. That or X2, I feel like people went back and forth on which one was the better one.
Something about the sequels where they got it right the second time.
Yeah. They also wrote the screenplays for Shanghai Noon, Shanghai Nights, and Herbie Fully Loaded.
Oh, okay. All right. Those Shanghai movies are a lot of fun.
And more recently, they co-created the TV series Into the Badlands and Wednesday.
Oh, okay.
And they wrote the screenplay for the upcoming sequel, Beetlejuice.
Oh, what do you know? So these guys have a very good career.
Yes. I mean, of a successful career, it looks like. Not entirely my taste. Definitely some high-profile projects.
Cool.
So Goffin Malar conceived a script about a Chinese mummy who wants to take over the world with his accursed army in the 1940s. This was based on the real-life emperor Qin Shi Huang, who was buried alongside thousands of terracotta soldiers, which we know today as the Terracotta Army. So, real thing. A lot of this movie was sort of inspired by real stuff.
Which inspired the very first original mummy movie that we covered way back in the Universal black and white days of the 30s, right? It was, what was that, King Tut's tomb that they unearthed? And they're like, oh boy, like, what if it was cursed?
Yeah.
Let's make the movie. We found our new monster.
Basically, yeah. So their original script featured many callbacks to the previous mummy movies, including Ziyuan traveling to Hamunaptra to make a terracotta copy of the Book of the Dead, which would have also been used to resurrect the emperor rather than the Elixir of Life, which it eventually changed to. Also, the bar staff at Jonathan's nightclub would have been styled with Aung San Aman's body paint, and Alex's slingshot would have played a vital role in defeating the emperor. The emperor Akamura also would have shared similarities with Imhotep, most notably the ability to suck the life force out of his victims to inherit various body parts he would need, and the ability to make impressions of his face in the elements the way Imhotep did with sand and water. But this time, it would have been part of an avalanche sequence.
Well, we get the avalanche. They say he can control the elements like Avatar: The Last Airbender, but they don't really explore that to its fullest the way I wish they did.
That was another thing. He also would have had similar control over elements, including freezing and unfreezing a river to escape, rapidly shooting fireballs from his hands, making quote-unquote snow arms to drag enemies underground, and making a rain cloud with water from the spring of eternal life to raise his army.
This all sounds great. It's good to get the script sold and greenlit.
The story also would have been set during World War II instead of after, with Rick and Evie actively working as spies for the British government, keeping an eye on Okamura, believing he had a secret plan to defeat the Japanese, only to discover later that he's the emperor. It's not a comprehensive account of everything included, but you know, you kind of get the idea. This was going to be a very, very big movie. By March 2006, the film was officially in development, and that September, Universal offered the film to director Joe Johnston, who was also considered for Jurassic World, but he declined. In January 2007, Universal officially announced that Stephen Sommers would not be directing, and that they began discussions with Rob Cohen to direct, and he, of course, is the one who landed the gig.
All right, Rob Cohen, also known for directing, only say this because it's important to the network, but Fast and Furious.
That's right. I do want to like address one thing before we start talking about Rob Cohen. We have to address that he has multiple sexual abuse allegations against him that began in 2019. Now, as of this recording, everything is still up in the air, so there hasn't been an official ruling one way or the other. But, you know, we definitely support victims in situations such as these. Until we hear otherwise, that's going to be our stance. We hope for a swift resolution to these situations.
Yeah. This also kind of felt, I was thinking about it earlier, directorless. Like, it feels like on autopilot a lot. Like, everyone knows what to do at this point and who they are and what they're like. How much do you really need to direct Brendan Fraser as Rick O'Connell at this point, or John Hannah?
I have heard quite a bit about Rob Cohen's actual like personal fascination with China. I think this was sort of a dream project for him to get to go to China and shoot an action movie. He's a practicing Buddhist. That's kind of his thing. If I had to guess, I would suspect, you know, like you said, you don't really need to direct Brendan Fraser in a mummy movie, but a lot of the China stuff was probably his contribution.
Fair enough.
So Rob Cohen actually had a pretty fascinating career prior to The Mummy. And as you said, the Fast and the Furious, there's a lot of stuff I didn't know about him. His Hollywood career began in the early 70s. He had landed a job as a script reader for Orion Pictures co-founder and former TriStar Pictures chairman Mike Medavoy. And 6 weeks into his job, he discovered a script that he described in his coverage as, quote, the great American screenplay, and this will make an award-winning major cast, major director film. End quote. He tirelessly pushed Medavoy to sell it, putting his own job at risk, and Universal did buy it, and it became The Sting. And from that point on, he became known as, quote, the kid who found The Sting. After his success with The Sting, he became the head of current programming at 20th Century Fox Television, helping out with a number of shows, including the first season of MASH, then distinguished himself by cold calling executives at ABC and CBS, introducing himself as the head of television movies at Fox, and sold a bunch of unproduced projects contracts that Fox just had laying around. And despite not being thrilled by this type of behavior by a junior employee, Fox president William Edwin Self grudgingly gave Cohen the title of Vice President of TV Movies. He also became friends with Berry Gordy, the founder of Motown, which led to his being named Executive Vice President and head of Motown's Motion Picture Division. He produced the first Motown film, 1975's Mahogany, starring Diana Ross, and at the same time produced 1976's critical hit, The Bingo Long Traveling All-Stars and Motor Kings, for which he hired future Dracula director John Badham. Through the 80s, Cohen produced a number of projects, including Miami Vice, Light of Day, The Witches of Eastwick, Ironweed, and The Wiz.
Directed a lot of stuff that I've seen multiple times. Dragon, the Bruce Lee Story, Daylight with Stallone, Triple X. I've never seen these, but like Stealth, Alex Cross.
I think a lot of our audience probably would know him from his 90s and 2000s output, as you mentioned, Fast and the Furious and Triple X. You know, I certainly remember Triple X when I was younger. And, you know, like that's the Rob Cohen I knew. I had no idea that he was pretty instrumental in some pretty big projects through the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, it seems like he started there and then became a director later on.
Okay, so in January 2007, Universal announced that the story would revolve around Rick and Evie O'Connell, as well as their adult son, and negotiations were underway. By May, Brendan Fraser and John Hannah were officially back on board. Luke Ford was cast as Alex, and Jet Li and Michelle Yeoh were also attached. Rachel Weisz, on the other hand, did not return, citing, quote, problems with the script, end quote, in addition to just having given birth to her son.
Oh, okay, so she's a new mother. That makes total sense.
But yeah, she was subsequently replaced by Maria Bello. Filming took place later that year on location in Montreal for the Shangri-La sequences, as well as the Terracotta Mausoleum. Later in China at Shanghai Studios for the street chase sequence, as well as the Ming Village near Tianmo for General Yang's camp. And additional filming took place in the UK at Shepperton Studios and Waddesdon Manor. As with the first two Mummy films, this one used a combination of old school practical effects and state-of-the-art digital effects. This time the digital effects were accomplished by two visual effects houses, Rhythm and Hughes, for the Yetis and the dragon effects and all of that, and Digital Domain for the battle sequences. A couple of fun facts about the effects. The pool of water that looked like diamonds took Rhythm and Hughes 11 months to complete, and the AI software Massive, which was developed for the Lord of the Rings films, was used for the undead battle scenes. Massive stands for Multiple Agent Simulation System in Virtual Environment. So basically, that allows them to create these like AI characters who kind of all behave uniquely, but then on a massive scale. They can have like hundreds or thousands of these characters, as opposed to like creating them all individually. So I think that's pretty neat. Okay, let's get into our cast here. Of course, Brendan Fraser comes back as Rick O'Connell. As I mentioned, Maria Bello replaced Rachel Weisz as Evie.
Yes.
Maria Bello from Norristown, Pennsylvania. She began acting on television in the early 90s, but her breakthrough came with the short-lived mid-90s series Mr. and Mrs. Smith, in which she starred alongside Scott Bakula. Do you remember that show, Mike?
No. What in the world? That sounds amazing. I love Bakula. So I was a big Quantum Leap fan growing up. I didn't know really Maria. I mean, I know her looking at her filmography now. It's like, wow, I've seen her in tons of stuff, but I've never been able to kind of pick her out of a crowd in a movie. But whoa, like she's kind of done a little bit of everything, you know, History of Violence to Coyote Ugly to like Grown Ups to, you know, like it just, she does it all. And I actually think like she shows off like all of that versatility in this role. Like, I think she does a great job here. I'm down like with the character, not the actor. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think she does a great job embodying the spirit of the character and she seems to be having a great time. I'm down with it.
Maybe it's because I'm more familiar with her from things. Like, she's not a bad actor by any means. I still have to get through a little bit of her bio here. You know, I really think she's a great actor, but she doesn't bring the same thing that Rachel Weisz does for me. And I'm not saying that Evie can't be played by somebody else. It's just, I feel like Maria Bello is a little too hard. I don't necessarily buy the sort of sweet librarian side of her.
Time has passed, right? They've been through war and a lot of adventure. I don't know. I just feel like it was a good idea to set it so far apart from the last movie, you know, now that like their kid is all grown up, you can do stuff with him and like, you know, it not explains, but helps with the recast a little bit.
Right.
A lot of time has passed, but I hear what you're saying. There's a bit more innocence maybe, or less assuming, right? Like I see Maria Bello and I'm like, oh, right. Kind of like a Tomb Raider.
Right.
She looks like a Tomb Raider. Rachel Weisz is like, oh, you know, I would never really expect her to like get down and dirty, yet she does.
The tough side of Evie, you know, she handles pretty spot on. Really, my issue might come down to her chemistry with Brendan Fraser. I have trouble buying their chemistry together as this married couple. So it's a neat problem.
Their marriage is in trouble. Like, I think that's part of it too, is like, they're like watchmen. It's like, they can't get it on unless they're like out there adventuring. That's what it feels like in this movie. It's just like domestic impotence kind of thing is setting in. And it's like, you know, I need to get excited by getting out there.
Yeah. Well, curious to know what our listeners think. So after Mr. and Mrs. Smith got canceled after only 8 weeks, that role did land her a series regular spot on ER in the fourth season. And then she made the leap to movies in the 2000s. As you mentioned, Coyote Ugly, A History of Violence. She was in The Cooler as well with William H. Macy. Was nominated for a Golden Globe for The Cooler and A History of Violence. And in 2009, The Guardian named her one of the best actors never to have received an Academy Award nomination. However, she did just win a Primetime Emmy for her performance in the series Beef. Maria Bello is a fantastic actor. I love her in just about everything else I've ever seen her in. I think she might have been miscast here, and that's not her fault.
Okay.
John Hannah is back as Jonathan. Love him. Luke Ford, as I mentioned, is replacing Freddie Both as Alex. Ford is a Canadian-Australian actor who spent most of his career in Australian TV and movies. Tomb of the Dragon Emperor is by far the most high-profile project he's been a part of.
Oh, man, he hasn't really done too much since either that is kind of noteworthy, I guess.
No, and I think he's cool here.
It feels like this could have been his big break. He might have gone on to play like a superhero one day, but the Mummy series just kind of fizzled out.
I don't think the role is super challenging. I think he is totally believable as a grown-up Alex.
He still feels like Alex, like he's the mischievous kid. I actually kind of dig him. I think he's totally fine. I think this was actually like a wise move to make. Like if they were, you know, I suppose going to hand the series off to his character at some point, you know, they picked a perfectly fine guy to center it all around, you know?
That would have been a great move. They wanted to keep making Mummy movies that he could have definitely held his own as a lead of a franchise. Okay, so Jet Li plays the Dragon Emperor. Let's see, where do we start? Obviously, one of the most iconic Chinese actors and one of the greatest martial arts stars in the world. He began practicing wushu as a child, became a national all-around champion at just 12 years old, while the other two medalists were in their mid to late 20s. He retired from wushu at 18 due to a knee injury, and in 1982 made his film debut in 1982's Shaolin Temple. He quickly became a massive star in China, adopting the name Jet, a nickname he picked up during his wushu days due to his speed and grace, which also reflected the fact that his career was taking off. In 1998, he made his international film debut in Lethal Weapon 4, which was the first time he ever played a villain. He agreed to do Lethal Weapon 4 in exchange for the lead role in the 2000 action film Romeo Must Die. He eventually turned down the lead role in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, as well as the role of Seraph in the Matrix trilogy. And he was also the original Kato for the Green Hornet when that was still in development. He had moved on by the time they eventually got that going. But the early 2000s were still insanely successful for Jet Li, as he followed up Romeo Must Die with a string of films including The One, Kiss of the Dragon, Hero, Cradle to the Grave, Unleashed, Fearless, War, and The Forbidden Kingdom, starring alongside the likes of Jason Statham, DMX, Bob Hoskins, Morgan Freeman, and, of course, Jackie Chan.
Delroy Lindo is in The One as well. Let's not forget Delroy Lindo.
That's right. I almost forgot Donnie Yen is in Hero, I believe.
I've always loved Jet Li stuff because when I was even in high school, we would get bootleg Shaw Brothers films and things like that. So I was into Gordon Liu and those guys as well. So awesome. In 2002, he made that flick Hero. I remember seeing The One in theaters. Like, that movie is hilarious on a lot of levels. You should check it out. I don't want to spoil much, but it's a lot of fun. And he plays multiple versions of himself in that movie. His American career seemed to have not been what, you know, most of us might have expected, but he still got into the upper echelon of Hollywood stardom.
He reached a point where even as early as The One, where the studio could market a movie with the name Jet Li, he was pretty popular right away in America. His career is incredible.
Oh, he's an expendable? Now I gotta watch it.
He is, yeah. He's in one of them, yeah. So we got Michelle Yeoh as Z-Yuan. We've talked about this. She's another staple of Hong Kong action and martial arts films. She was also Miss Malaysia 1983. Didn't know that. She began acting in her early 20s, appearing in Guy LaRoche watch commercials with Jackie Chan before catching the attention of D&B Films, which is a Hong Kong production company. She got the lead in her third film, 1985's Yes, Madam, and in 1987 married her first husband, D&B Films co-founder Dixon Poon, before retiring from acting. Their marriage lasted only 5 years, and she just went right back into acting. But this time, you know, she really made a name for herself as an action star in the 90s, starting with Police Story 3's Super Cop, as well as the heroic trio, as you mentioned, Tai Chi Master with Jet Li, and of course, the movie Wing Chun, which also has Donnie Yen in it. She did many of her own stunts before launching her Hollywood career in 1997, co-starring with Pierce Brosnan in Tomorrow Never Dies.
Oh my gosh, she's so great in that. They're so good together.
Yes, I'm a Bond fan, and there's a lot of things I could criticize Tomorrow Never Dies for, but I cannot deny Pierce Brosnan and Michelle Yeoh on screen together is incredible. She did go on to co-star in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, as well as Memoirs of a Geisha and Danny Boyle's Sunshine.
Oh, so good. Big cast.
And then eventually, of course, she got Tomb of the Dragon Emperor. These days, I mean, she's one of the biggest stars in the world. She's doing Marvel movies. She's in Star Trek. And of course, she just became the first Malaysian to be nominated for and win an Academy Award, as well as the first Asian and second woman of color to win the Best Actress Oscar.
Same goes for her that I feel like goes for Jet Li, the Kung Fu movies and all that kind of stuff first. And then her American career seemed to have just been a little more kind of like selective and prestigious. I've not seen Crazy Rich Asians, but I heard it's a really good movie. I should check that out. Everything Everywhere All at Once, I really dig that. And then she's in like the Avatar stuff. So yep. It'd be so cool if she came back somehow into the Monsterverse.
I would love it. I don't know which would make the most sense unless they created a new monster. But yeah, I mean, she'd be great in anything. Russell Wong plays General Ming Guo. That is Ziwan's lover in the past.
Okay. Oh, right. Yes.
He was the son of a restaurateur and was born in Troy, New York. He trained to be a dancer at Santa Monica City College before moving to Hong Kong, where he worked as a dancer and a model. He began acting in the mid-80s and became one of the first actors of Chinese descent to star in a primetime American TV series, co-starring in Vanishing Sun in the mid-90s. He's since appeared in Abel Ferrara's China Girl, New Jack City, The Joy Luck Club, and Romeo Must Die, among others. Most recently, he was in Clifford the Big Red Dog, and he did a few episodes of Westworld. So still very much active as an actor.
Interesting how much these actors worked with each other.
Isabella Liang plays Lin. She was born in Macau, found herself having to support her family at a very young age, and left school when she was only 12 years old to become a model for the Emperor Entertainment Group in Hong Kong. She released an album entitled Isabella when she was 16, but it failed to achieve the success she was hoping for, and so she turned to acting. She made a string of films between 2005 and 2007, including the third film in the original I trilogy, if you're familiar with the original,
yeah.
The I, the I 2, and then she was in the I 10, which was the third.
Whoa. Movie. Wait, 1, 2, and 10?
So that wasn't the international title. That was like the original title. And I think there's like 10 different things going on with the I.
I see.
They didn't use the numerical part of it like we do, like it was the 10th movie. I don't know.
I understand.
Confusing.
I hear you. But I like the original Eye. I have seen the original The Eye. I thought it was creepy.
Yeah, I haven't seen any of those. I still need to. Yeah, so The Mummy, Tomb of the Dragon Emperor was her first American film.
Yeah, I didn't know her from anything, and I thought she held up perfectly fine. Like, she has screen presence, you know? Like, it seemed like she'd been acting in American movies for years, just like everyone else.
Yep, and solid chemistry with Luke Ford, I thought. Their relationship is kind of hammy. It's a little, like, unnecessary.
He's really into her, and she's 10,000 years old.
Right.
You know,
but as far as just having chemistry together, because they spend most of the movie with each other, I thought they were pretty fun together. Anthony Wong plays General Yang. He was the son of a Chinese mother and an English father who later abandoned the family when he was only 4. And so Wong also became an actor to support his family. He began in his 20s, often being typecast as villains due to his mixed race and the institutionalized racism in the Hong Kong film industry, about which he has been known for being very outspoken. He's an incredibly prolific actor, having worked on tons of projects through the 90s and 2000s, including some high-profile films that you've seen, Mike, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Hard Boiled, The Heroic Trio, Infernal Affairs, and The Medallion.
Yeah, he definitely looked familiar to me.
No, I haven't seen Infernal Affairs yet, but my understanding is that he plays the Jack Nicholson character if you are watching The Departed.
Departed's great and all, but like, yeah, Infernal Affairs is just like off the charts. It's amazing.
I have a copy that you gave me once years ago.
Oh, cool.
and I have yet to watch it. So I think after this, I might have to do that.
Hard Boiled. I think I just found my copy of that. So I got to watch that again soon. I was really into that in The Killer when we were in college together.
Oh, yeah.
I was a big John Woo fan back in college. Did like lots of reports on him.
Like I finally like sat down and watched Hard Boiled and The Killer 1 week. I think my girlfriend was out of town. And so I thought, okay, now I'm not committed to watching anything. I can watch whatever I want. And then so I put on both of those movies that week and got a real education. I hadn't like properly seen like real John Woo. I had seen American John Woo.
Which is good too.
But it's very different.
Quite. He made a Van Damme film. He made a Cage film. He made a Shaw Brothers film called The Last Hurrah for Chivalry. You should check that. That's a wushu film. That's a really good one too. Interesting one. We're getting way off track.
But. Yeah. It's okay. Jesse Meng plays Choi, who is General Yang's colonel. She's got a tiny role in the film, but worth mentioning. An actor of Taiwanese descent, also a model and a TV host. She hasn't done a whole lot of acting. She's really just appeared in a handful of movies, including this one, but she is predominantly a runway model now. I heard on the director commentary that Rob Cohen wanted, because she's a model, right? He wanted to give her some sort of characteristic. He didn't want her to have this like beautiful, gorgeous model face. So that's why she has the big scar on her face.
Oh, I see.
According to some, you know, maybe it achieved the opposite effect. And, you know, she's even more attractive now with the scar. I don't know. Yeah, that was the reason for that scar, just because she was a model and they were trying to like get her away from that a little bit for the role.
Oh, yeah. I just figured she was badass and there was just history there. Yeah.
For the little bit of screen time she gets, she's pretty awesome in this. Okay, last two. David Calder as Professor Roger Wilson. I love David Calder. He's a prolific English actor and as such has appeared in a lot of plays and British television shows. The list is way too long for us to discuss here, but I picked out a couple of credits that stood out to me, including The World Is Not Enough and Ron Howard's Rush. And more recently, I've seen him play Julius Caesar in the National Theater production of Julius Caesar from 2017 or 2018, which also included Ben Whishaw, Michelle Fairley, and David Morrissey. That was like one of those Fathom events, I think, where it was like a live broadcast of a National Theater production.
I always wanted to check that out. You're way more cultured than I am,
dude. I don't know if that's true. I mean, I do try.
It looks like he's in one of my favorite recent movies, The Lost City of Zed, which I loved about Percy Fawcett.
Finally, Liam Cunningham from Game of Thrones. Here he is as Mad Dog McGuire. He began his career at 15 years old, learning to be an electrician. In the 80s, he moved to Zimbabwe, working as an electrician. And then after 3 years, he was dissatisfied with his career and turned to acting, taking classes and working at local theaters, including the Royal Shakespeare Company. He began doing films in the early 90s and basically hasn't stopped ever since. To me, he's always going to be Davos Seaworth, the Onion Knight in Game of Thrones.
Missing his fingertips and all that. And Dan, this ain't the last we're going to see of him, because down the line, he is going to chart the Demeter on its last voyage. So we'll see him then.
That's right. At the end of this season, I guess, unless they come out with something
unless
new.
Unless something else happens, yeah.
I think that catches us up. But yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing him in that as well. I still haven't seen it yet. I don't know. I'll probably watch it before we get there. Missed it in theaters, and now I'm just kind of like dragging my feet. So looking forward to that one. Okay, that's our cast. That's our production. Kind of wild. A lot of cool actors in this movie. Let's get into the story here. This is the first time our Universal logo has been manipulated, as far as I know, in the sort of modern era. This time, the globe, the Universal logo, acts as a map for the story.
Yeah, doesn't it like spin and zoom in?
It zooms in on China, yeah.
It got me thinking back to all of the chat we used to have about when the logo changed and when it's going to change next and all that kind of stuff. And it kind of got lost this season in a lot of the other things we were discussing. Man, this brought me back to that, like, oh, cool. They did something awesome with the logo.
Yeah, it was super cool. I wasn't prepared for it. I really enjoy that sort of like twist on the traditional logo there. I'm going to see if I can sum up the sort of prologue as succinctly as I can. So the movie opens in ancient China during civil war. There's basically one guy who had the ambition to become emperor and unite China. So it was like broken up into factions, right? And as he is rising to power, the leaders of these other factions sent assassins to try and stop him, but they were no match for him and his army. And all of his enemies who were defeated were like they were forced to build what became the Great Wall of China.
Yeah. Oh, man. There's that one crazy scene early on where they're just hauling corpses into the foundation of the Great Wall of China. I was like, wow, that was gnarly.
Yeah. Anybody who died on the job or was too weak to go on were buried beneath the Great Wall, which is important. It will come into play later. Mystics taught him to command the five elements, which are fire, water, earth, wood, and metal.
Okay.
He decided that the last enemy that he needed to defeat was death. He asked his childhood friend, his general, Ming, to find a witch who could help him live forever. This ended up being Ziyuan, Michelle Yeoh's character. By the way, I feel like I should address this. I am trying to pronounce everybody's names correctly. I'm sure I'm going to butcher some of them, so I apologize in advance. So anyway, they find her, and as soon as he sets eyes on her, the emperor, he's like, nobody's allowed to touch her but me. She doesn't have the specific ability to make him immortal, but she knows of this thing, the Oracle Bones, which is the mystic book of this movie. She and Ming travel to the monastery of Turfan to find the Oracle Bones, and that's where they kind of fall in love. Once they return, she reads a spell from the book that the emperor believes will make him immortal. And he at some point realizes that Ming and she are having something on the side. And so he arranges for his men to kill Ming if she doesn't devote the rest of her life to the emperor. And so she doesn't. Ming is killed. And then the emperor realizes that the spell that was cast on him was not of immortality, but it turns him and his entire army into terracotta statues.
Technically a version of immortality, right? Because they become dormant, like they can awaken again in the future at some point. But still, it's like a monkey paws kind of deal.
What I thought was cool about that sequence is that Michelle Yeoh is actually speaking Sanskrit. Now, in Stephen Sommers' original Mummy movie, the 1999 film, I know we talked about how no one speaks ancient Egyptian anymore. So they had to kind of do their best approximation of what ancient Egyptian sounded like. Today, there are some people who can speak and read Sanskrit. There aren't many, but they do exist. And so they got like the only person in North America who can speak Sanskrit to work on this movie as a consultant. And so she's actually speaking Sanskrit, which I thought was really cool.
Nice. A lot to kind of digest here in the opening with the voiceover and all that going on. But however, still not dissimilar to a degree than what we're used to, you know? So like, although it's a different time and place, there's still a beloved betrayal of a type. You know, there's still the quest for immortality. There's still the magic books. We're also introducing the idea of different things, such as like Michelle Yeoh is referred to as a witch.
Yes.
At one point, we're adding witches to the monster verse, I guess, here, right? Like, technically, it's a witch.
In the Scorpion King, we had a sorceress. So,
yeah.
Yeah, it makes sense.
So, I like that. Like, I'm down with all this. I think it's a little long. Like, they wrapped it up so quickly in the first one.
Yes.
You know, the first one is just so perfectly tight opening kind of thing. I don't know if they needed, again, like their earthbending powers. Those don't come into play enough. Maybe that guy could have been left out. It makes it a little confusing. Like, is he a sorcerer? I'm not sure. He's going to end up turning and morphing into certain things later. But overall, I'm still down. I think this is a perfectly fine setup for our new mummy bad guy.
In the 99 mummy, so much of that backstory could have been told visually. You don't really need to explain it, even though they kind of do. It's like a pretty simple love triangle, a forbidden romance, a betrayal, and then the consequences of that. Here, you're dealing with magic and the Chinese Civil War. And it's also, you know, I feel like Chinese culture isn't as familiar to American audiences as Egyptian culture seems to be, or at least the Mummy prologue didn't rely on a familiarity with Egyptian culture, right? It's just a love triangle.
The association of the word mummy and the imagery of like pyramids and hieroglyphics of that region, you connect with that a little easier, quicker than you would say, like when you hear mummy and you think of China,
right?
You don't necessarily think of like a guy wrapped up in bandages or anything.
I do feel you on it feeling a little bit long, although I don't mind it because I know we're going to get Rick and Evie. You know, like I know we're going to get those things that we are familiar with, the things we enjoy. So we got Jet Li. Let's get as much Jet Li as we can.
I also think transforming into the Clay Man is like really cool too. So
yeah, instead of being buried alive, I thought that was a really fun twist too. In reality, it wasn't the same emperor who built the Great Wall of China, you know, had the terracotta army. Those things were not all tied to a single emperor of China, right? But they kind of play loose with the Chinese history so that, like, we recognize everything, right? Like, oh, we've seen the terracotta army. We've seen that. We know what the Great Wall is, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and who's to say in this universe, maybe it is how it went down, you know, in the world where magic actually does exist.
Now we've got our setup. We cut to 1946 in Oxfordshire, England. Rick and Evie are now retired adventurers. They were spies during the war, which we will learn. We catch up with Rick as he is fly fishing and doing very poorly at it. And Evie has spent her time writing books about their experiences.
That is awesome. Yes. I love that concept. You know, like, she was a librarian, so the idea that she would become an author and that she is like cribbing her life.
Yes.
And the covers of those mummy books are amazing. They look like the old posters.
I know. I want copies of those to hang on my wall because they're really fun. I kind of love that this is where Rick and Evie are in 1946, just trying to fill the time, clearly unhappy with, you know, staying at home and not going on adventures.
Yeah, this whole thing of them being restless is a lot of fun. But I also love the added thing where Evie's like, I gotta write another book, right? Like, I've got a book deal. I need to go on another adventure. They're like, all of these excuses they're making for themselves to try and get the hell out of the house.
I did enjoy that moment where during the book reading, one of the women in the crowd like asks about the similarities between the main female character of the book and Evie. That's like the reveal of Maria Bello, right? Her head comes up and she says, honestly, I can say she's a completely different person. That is the first sentence she says looking at the camera. And I always thought, okay, that's clever.
Yeah, that's the wink and nod to the audience. That's like in Iron Man 2 when Don Cheadle comes in and he's like, hey, it's me. Get over it. I'm here. Let's move on. I think it's fun when they recognize that they've done this.
Yeah, it's like George Lazenby's This Never Happened to the Other Fellow in On Her Majesty's Secret Service. I thought that was fun. Once we establish Rick and Evie, we cut to the Ningxia province in China, where Alex and his professor Wilson have discovered the Emperor's tomb and his terracotta army. This is a really cool sequence. This is very Indiana Jones, more so than we've gotten in the past. I know that was sort of in the back of Stephen Sommers' mind with the first two Mummy movies. This crypt very much feels like Indiana Jones more than that.
Well, apparently, like, because Indiana Jones was like taking stuff from real life, and this place and places like this were actually like booby-trapped heavily and still are, to the degree that, like, I've heard they haven't even uncovered all of the terracotta area of the army that, like, is there because they're still mapping traps.
Yes. So that was one of the things I learned, I think, from the director's commentary, is that specifically that poison gas that shoots up out of the floor.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the crossbows. Those are all kind of inspired by actual traps found in these ancient tombs. It's absolutely wild. But I really enjoy this sequence. It's a lot of fun. I like that it starts with the Colossus, like this giant statue.
There's a big callback. We had that in the first Mummy where they were digging under the giant statue and this and that and everything, and that is cool. It seems like they got a great big set going on with lots of big moving pieces. I'm totally with it. Like I said, like, I really feel like there's a good, like you mentioned, the pacing. Like, I think it's spot on. I remember remarking in The Mummy 2 that it felt like we were kind of like entering the movie a little too late. I mean, not that that's bad, but just for my taste, like, it felt like even too late. Here, we're right on time. All this is playing out just how I want, pretty much.
Let's not forget, we are also introduced to Lin in this scene. We don't know who she is yet. She's basically dressed like a ninja.
Yeah.
As Alex and his team are lowering into the tomb, they find the emperor. She comes in and there's like a whole fight scene. She does not succeed. They manage to overpower her by the end of it. We will learn more about her later. I kind of love that Lin is sort of the new Ardeth Bay.
Oh, yeah.
She is the one who has been tasked with protecting this tomb and preventing the emperor from being resurrected. Except Ardeth Bay wasn't hundreds of years old.
You just answered a question I was going to bring up later, is why isn't that guy here? Why didn't they call Ardeth Bay to be like, hey, man, like, we finally got another adventure. And he's like at home with like a beer belly waiting. But it's because it's her. She is that character now in this movie. They like rebooted that character. She serves that same purpose. So that's cool.
Yes. Rick and Evie are eventually called back into action by the British government. This time they want them to travel back to China with the Eye of Shangri-La.
They're ambassadors. That's their cover story, at least. And they are so anxious to get out of the house. They don't even ask any questions. They don't know like who their contact is even, really, do they? They definitely don't know that their son is in the same town, kind of working on the same project. I don't know. I just feel like they're over anxious. They're definitely also being taken advantage of right now too, then they don't know it, you know, they're just not on the ball.
Yeah, it's like they're looking at each other for permission to say yes. They both want to do it very clearly.
Oh man, Brendan Fraser is just so good at that kind of line between being a goofball and being like someone who's like responsible. You know, it never gets to the point where he's too stupid, but like he pushes it so close, but then he takes it the other way and he's like super heroic and you're like, all right, there it is.
He's not unlike, you know, Han Solo in that way. He can rise to the occasion when, you know, someone's got a gun to his head. But at the same time, he never really loses that sort of charisma. You know, he always can find something to joke about.
But I feel like Rick doesn't mind being the joke now these days, even. He's experienced that growth of confidence where, you know, he doesn't always have to be the baddest badass in the room because he knows he is.
As he says later in the movie, he's defeated one mummy two times. This is kind of old hat for him. They don't really resist the temptation very much. One thing we do learn about the Eye of Shangri-La, this is an important detail. It'll come into play later. It has the power to grant eternal life. Yeah. We know where this movie's going. We know that this Eye of Shangri-La is going to be instrumental to bringing the Emperor back, making him immortal. After this scene, finally, we go to Shanghai, to Jonathan's nightclub, which is Egyptian themed and called Imhoteps.
It looked somewhat familiar to me. I was like, I remember this idea from something.
For the second time now, we have seen nightclubs themed after dangerous immortal mummies. This time it's Imhotep, but previously we saw this at the end of Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy. After they defeat Clarice, they open up, was it Clarice Cafe?
It's like a mummy nightclub. It's like the Egyptian mummy themed nightclub. It's like the same exact thing. And I thought it fit perfectly, especially for the Jonathan character, who is basically Abbott and Costello, yeah. Now that I think about it,
yes.
Wrapped up into one perfect little freaking British package.
I was basically the Leonardo DiCaprio meme from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So yeah, I love that this is where Jonathan has ended up. I love the whole nightclub. And this is where Rick and Evie arrive. Alex arrives, although they don't know that they're all arriving here at the same time.
Yeah, there's like the whole congregation's coming together. It's nice to see Jonathan kind of freaking out for once. On sure. This level, you know, where he's like, I'm your uncle, I'm supposed to be responsible, but yet you're not even supposed to be here. I'm starting to regret this because you're too much like your parents and like I'm not prepared for all this. And then it's like, oh shit, here are your parents. How do I juggle all this? And like he clearly kind of can't. He kind of just like throws his arms up and like lets it all play out.
Yeah, this is John Hannah just in his element. It's still like wild to me that prior to being cast in these movies, he never thought of himself as a comedic actor. Blows my mind. So everyone arrives at the nightclub on the same night. Alex, who is supposed to be in school, gets into a fight with this guy for kind of hitting on his girl.
Yeah, isn't it Leon Cunningham? Isn't it Maguire?
Yes. We discover that it's Mad Dog Maguire and that Rick knows him. He's the old friend from the past who's going to help out this time around.
First, it was the very old guy with the biplane. Then yes. It was the dude with the airship.
Yep.
Now it's Mad Dog.
Yes. Rick has friends all over. This time, this friend doesn't want to kick his ass.
I like this whole kind of like, I don't know if it's so much like a misunderstanding, but like they come in and it's kind of like, Alex, dad, mom, Alex. And then Mad Dog's like, your son was trying to, what, hit on his wife? He's like, I'm going to have to kick your son's ass. And he's like, come on, like, let me take care of this. Like, I'll buy you a drink. I was like, what is it going on?
Clearly, this family dynamic is on shaky ground. That'll become a major theme throughout the movie.
Yeah, has he been, like, not missing, but they, like, shipped him off to school and he, like, ran away to become this? Bumming around now, like, looking for treasure?
I mean, he is with his professors. But yeah, I think he was meant to be in school and he just discovered where this tomb might be. received funding for his expedition, which we'll talk about.
It's like a thesis project.
Basically.
What are they complaining about? This is a good thing that he's not in school, because technically he is in school. Like, he's doing the school work.
Yeah, it's like a work study program.
Exactly.
After this, we go over to this paramilitary outpost out in the middle of China. And this is where we get to meet General Yang and his Colonel Choi. And we learn of Yang's plans to steal the Eye of Shangri-La, to resurrect the emperor, and bring order to all of the chaos in China.
He thinks he can control a supernatural terracotta mummy from the past. Good luck. That's like where everyone goes wrong. They're like, I'm going to resurrect the mummy and like tell him what to do. No, you're not.
General Yang, by the end of this, kind of becomes our Benny character. Benny didn't set out to resurrect this mummy, but he's very much so like, hey, I resurrected you and I'm here to do your bidding.
Yeah, he becomes his sniveling sidekick.
Yes. Back at the museum, Professor Wilson is eventually revealed to be a double agent, kind of. He's been working for Yang.
But first, the O'Connells come. Is this when they come and give him the eye, right?
Yes.
Yeah, they come and they're like, hey, we did it. Here's the eye. Like, it was too easy. Wish you gave us something harder to do. And I think Evie's the only one who can, like, read the inscription. She drops a line where she's like, oh, look, like, this is a very difficult thing here to read, and only I'm one of the people who can do it. And then they deliver the eye to Wilson, and he, like, not exactly like this, but he, like, immediately pulls a gun on him and is like, haha, I'm bad. I'm going to steal all this. Here's my master plan. Talk about James Bond. And he's like, you have to read the inscription to raise the dead mummy.
Right. And Yang and Choi show up, and that's where we find out that Yang financed the dig.
Right, yeah.
And so he's come to collect Alex, who has left the room, runs into Lin, who is there.
They did this one thing. There's not a scene of it, but they did the thing they should never do that I think I always say is like, don't ever do this, is they move the mummy stuff.
Well, he was on a chariot when they found him, but they moved everything from the tomb into the museum.
Never do that, right? Like, you never want to resurrect the mummy in your hometown. Why take that extra step? You know, if you're going to do that, you're going to have to work your way back to China anyway to raise his warriors. So just do it all there.
The inscription on the Eye of Shangri-La says, only a drop of blood from a person with a pure heart can open the eye. They go to threaten Rick. Evie tries to save him. They make the argument that by making that selfless act, that she was the one who was pure of heart. They draw some blood. It opens up the eye and it resurrects the emperor. Lin and Alex are up in the rafters. They sort of accidentally trigger the revival of the emperor when they swing down to save Rick from being shot.
It falls out of their hands and splashes on them,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. Basically. So there's a whole fight scene here, lots of gunfire. Wilson is decapitated in this scene.
I was definitely expecting him to last longer, and I was not expecting to see his severed head fly across the screen like that.
No, but it was pretty cool. I like the effects of this terracotta character coming to life. I thought all of that was really neat. And this is where he breathes fire. He pulls off the terracotta from his face and breathes fire like a dragon.
Yeah, later he's going to throw his face at someone and it always kind of like grows back and it looks extremely painful. The thing about like the firepower, so I guess that has to more to do with like his airbending, like his elemental powers. He's just going to be a big old dragon later. So he's just getting the fire breathing out of the way early.
The fight goes out into the street and we get our big chase scene. And this was actually like a really fun sequence. I think it's gorgeous the way they shot this nighttime Shanghai.
Mm. Yeah, I liked it more than the one from part two that was in London, the London double-decker chase thing. Like, there's just something a little more about this. Maybe it's the chariot.
They're in a much more populated area and there's a lot of lights. You know, like just aesthetically, it's more interesting to look at than the streets of London at the middle of the night. Those are empty streets.
True.
And there's fireworks. I think altogether it's a lot more exciting and more interesting to look at than that bus scene in The Mummy Returns. I really like this scene. I love the way that they use multiple fireworks set pieces here. They blow up a lot of things. The action is all pretty well orchestrated. Jonathan's ass gets set on fire. If there's one thing I would change about this movie, it might be that they have John Hannah say, smack my ass, smack my ass.
I don't know. This needs a little more of that cheekiness. Maybe there was always that missing element of the sexual innuendo in the double meaning of dialogue. That was never really in the previous Mummy movies, but maybe that's something that was lacking, is that coded kind of adult humor. Not overt, not talking like, you know, potty humor or anything like that, but just stuff that could be misconstrued or taken another way if you're a little more sort of in on a private joke or something like that.
That one particular line, it rang very sophomoric to me.
If he had been able to go further with that line.
Because like later he's going to make a really terrible yak joke. And I'm thinking like, this is not really what I want from one of these movies. Like these are the jokes that like, I don't know. I think they were going for like the kids with those jokes.
Oh, most definitely. Yeah.
It doesn't fit with the rest of it for me.
I agree with that. You take out more of that and you try and add a little more subversive humor.
I see. Like, okay. Yeah. Yeah, I definitely agree with that. Great set piece. The Emperor and Yang escape. Now everybody is back at Imhotep's, kind of taking stock of everything. This is where we learn that Lin is sort of the Ardeth Bey and that her family has been watching over that tomb for centuries. She mentions that the Emperor can only be killed by a stab through the heart with this specific cursed dagger.
Mm-hmm.
And we learn the stakes of the movie. If the Emperor reaches Shangri-La and drinks from the pool of eternal life, he will raise his army and no one will be safe.
So I dig where they're going with this, right? But I don't know if I like how and when we get there. I'm going to skip ahead just a little bit, but not all the way. We're eventually going to get to Shangri-La.
Yep.
And Shangri-La to me means so much. And we're going to spend so little time there that I wish we got there sooner in a sequence. It turns out to be a really fun sequence, but the sequence in the mountains, I feel like takes away a lot of the luster of Shangri-La. We don't get to spend a lot of time there. I wish the movie was just there longer. I just want to say that now before we get there, because it's mentioned now. Like Shangri-La is going to be such a big part of this movie, yes. And yet it's not going to be such a big part of this movie. And that in the end is where it fell apart for me. We'll get there. You know, I just wanted to preface all that.
I definitely agree with you. And I think that if they had gone in that direction and expanded on Shangri-La, and, you know, if this thing ended with sort of like a Ragnarok size finale in Shangri-La, right? Because it's this mystical place. There's all kinds of cool shit that could be in there.
Yeah.
Then that would have been a very different ending and maybe a more interesting ending. We'll talk about it when we get to that scene. You don't worry. I'm kind of with you on that.
Here is where I'm like, all right, I'm very excited to get there. And then I just feel like when we get there, it's just like, oh boy.
We learn that the gateway to Shangri-La lies in a mountain pass in the Himalayas. And beyond it is a golden tower. They have this diamond. The diamond is from the Eye of Shangri-La, if I'm not mistaken. Once it is placed at the top of that golden tower, it'll point the way to Shangri-La. So like Hominoptera, where you can only find it if you know where it is.
Good call. I feel like there might be one too many relics in this movie. I don't know that we need a mystical dagger to kill this guy. Maybe just like use the eye for everything, shove the eye in his face, or eat it or something, or just make sure he touches it. That ends up, for me personally, just bogged down, where it's like every time they meet a new character, they're like, oh, and I also have like this special item.
When I think about playing D&D, like it's cool if you find a magic item, but if you're finding magic items every time you play, then they stop being special. I think you're onto something. I hadn't really thought about it, but there are quite a few magic items in this that it's a little bit difficult to keep track of all of them and why they're all necessary. Okay, we're headed to the Himalayas. We need a way to get there. Enter Mad Dog McGuire, who is a terrible pilot, turns out, who doesn't even have seat belts in his plane because he was too cheap to install them.
The O'Connells are so wealthy, right? They live in Batman's house, pretty much. Like, they live in Wayne Manor. They live in the X Mansion. They show their house again in this movie, and it's just like they've got so much stuff. They could easily find a guy, pay for a guy with like way better experience and like equipment. It would have been so cool if they like had a scene where they went to some dude, like a Q scene where they went to some dude's house who they met in the army and were like, this guy's got all the gear. We met this dude in World War II. Like, you're not going to believe the kind of futuristic stuff this guy has built. Instead, they go to mad dog, like he's gonna help them after their son tried to make it with his wife. Like, I'm still not clear on what that was about, but it's just wild. I know I'm thinking too hard about it. It's just so funny to me.
The reason is that if they went with an actually skilled pilot, then you wouldn't have an adventure movie.
So I'm also thinking like they want to keep it in the inner circle, like they want everybody finding out about Shangri-La.
Actually, they do make it to the Himalayas, and that's where, of course, he's got, for some reason, is flying around with a yak who vomits into the vomit bag and all over Jonathan for the second worst line in the movie, the yak yacked.
But there's a really good landing special effects for the plane in the mountain. Like, that was great.
Yes, I do think that effect was really fun. It kind of reminded me of the original Italian Job, you know, that sort of like cliffhanging.
Yeah.
But yeah, I thought that was a really fun set piece. And then I love that Mad Dog's just like making food in the plane as everybody else is off having fun.
He should be out there helping, but I guess he needs to be on standby.
While they're trekking through the mountains, Yang returned to his men with the Emperor, has pledged allegiance to the Emperor, and now everybody in that crew is headed to the Himalayas to find Shangri-La. And then we get like some family stuff in there. Alex and Lin pretend not to be interested in each other. Alex is trying to establish a better relationship with his parents.
Rick and Alex comparing their guns is a little weird. You know?
Yeah. Oh, like, yeah. When they finally reach the gate and they're like preparing for, because they know the Emperor's coming. So they're like preparing for that. And they each have these giant cases full of guns. And it's thinly veiled dick measuring.
As we're talking about it, it feels like we got here really quickly. But like in movie time, isn't this like almost an hour or so in? It's been a while,
at least, yeah,
to get us to the Himalayas. I think, which is one of my issues, is like I only really want to watch another half hour. So I want to be in Shangri-La by now. I think that's where I was getting at earlier, where I was like, we get there late and leave there too early. Maybe they get there immediately, find the entrance immediately, instead of all of these like crazy things that are about to happen, and then everything else takes place in Shangri-La for the rest of the movie, right? Because like they should have to go in there and find the fountain. Instead, it's kind of like right on the outskirts, like right when they get there. This was the point where I was like, oh, we're not going to get there for a while now, but that's really where I wish we were going right from here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at my notes. By the time they get to Shangri-La, I really don't have a whole lot left.
It's almost like they have to contrive more reason to get there. It's like there's enough reason to get there. We don't really need Rick to get mortally wounded in the upcoming sequence to make it more important for us to get to Shangri-La and beat the mummy to the pool of life, you know? Like, right. We know what's going to happen.
Right.
So just keep him around. It's bumming me out that he's sidelined.
Before the Emperor arrives, of course, Rick and Alex are comparing their guns. One thing that stuck out to me as unusual, and maybe this stuck out to you as well, they're kind of like discussing what the plan is. And Rick expresses some sort of disbelief in the power of this magic dagger.
Why would he have any doubt? He stabbed the Scorpion King with a magic spear because he was supposed to be destined to do it. It was written on a wall, like in hieroglyphics, next to the mummy man.
If anybody should believe this and take it at face value, I feel like Rick O'Connell is the guy to do it.
I'm sure he killed the Red Skull during World War II. You know? they definitely sicked him on like the occult section of spy work.
It's just a strange moment for me. Okay, so the Emperor and Yang and everybody arrives. There's a whole firefight sequence, which is actually really fun.
Yeah.
They almost immediately have to go to their plan B, which is to destroy that golden tower. Basically, if we're not going to find Shangri-La, nobody's going to find it. Before anybody arrived, they had sort of rigged it with a bunch of dynamite, and now, like, that's the plan. So Jonathan is kind of in the background trying to get that to happen. And during the fight, Lin calls in for some reinforcements. She speaks some kind of language and essentially summons a couple Yetis to come help fight off the Emperor and his army.
Now, okay, I actually dig this a lot.
Yeah, I like the Yetis.
My original memory of it was that they were on the bad guy side for some reason. Watching it this time, I was like, oh, hell yeah, they're good Yetis. The design is really cool, too. Look, I'm just a sucker for Sasquatch,
sure,
Wendigo, all that stuff. Like, I love those kinds of cryptics and monsters. It was really fun, actually. I was like, okay, well, how far? This isn't very far removed from the Jackal. Right? Yeah. We had a bunch of jackals in the last movie. The one thing I want most is more monsters. So, like, here we go. We got Yetis in this. Like, I'll buy it. I'm cool. I still do have kind of a problem with the field goal.
Sure.
Okay. But aside from that, I dig it. I love when the avalanche happens and they shield their human friends. Very, very fun.
I'm with you. I love the sort of twist in that they are on our side, right? That they're good monsters. The effects in this scene are great. There's a lot of really cool stuff with the elements. The Dragon Emperor manipulates the snow and ice to stop the dynamite from blowing up the tower.
You know, you mentioned the effects. It's true because, like, there's so much, like, white, right? It's
a lot of
so
white.
Monochromatic, and yet you really don't have an issue kind of separating the creatures from the background or anything like that. Like, you know, everything pops the way it should.
Yeah. The Emperor eventually does succeed in getting that diamond placed atop the tower and finding Shangri-La. But in the subsequent fray, Alex creates an avalanche and Rick takes a sword in the gut. In the avalanche, as you mentioned, the Yetis kind of protect everybody from danger. Jonathan, of course, manages to get his hands on that big diamond, and everybody kind of hustles to Shangri-La to save Rick in the pool of eternal life.
Yeah, I guess it would be the fountain of, maybe it's the fountain of youth? Is it kind of like the same idea as the pool of life? I suppose there was a great movie, Lost Horizon. And just being there gives you your life back. Like, you don't have to, like, drink the water, but, like, it's just something in the air. You know, people who are in Shangri-La kind of, like, live forever until they leave. You know, I mean, I'm not complaining that they need to sort of bathe in the pool or anything like that. But it's just, I guess that's just the connection is just, like, with Shangri-La itself. It's like a place of eternal life.
Yes. And it's like you mentioned before, it's really only used to save Rick's life and to turn the Emperor into a giant three-headed dragon.
Which makes you think it would be more well guarded, but I don't even think right. There's any residents of Shangri-La.
So as they're in Shangri-La saving Rick, they find Ziwen's there. We learn that she and her daughter have been guarding the tomb of the Dragon Emperor for 2,000 some years. They have to keep watch over it to stop him from basically getting to the pool. So they have basically failed the task that they've been assigned.
It's kind of similar now that I think about it. I mean, there's so many parallels to Indy. It's very similar to The Last Crusade, yep. Where, like, there's the guy guarding the cups and, like, it's like, oh, there's a Nazi in my room. Like, I didn't guard this place well enough. But Shangri-La seems to have the same issue where it's like, oh no, like the wrong people found out all about us.
So the Emperor turns into a dragon and then takes off.
Well, he doesn't just turn into a dragon. Like, he has some words first, right? Like with Michelle Yeoh, where it's kind of like, you know.
Oh yeah, they've got a history.
I told you I'd be back and all this shit. And like, I'm going to get you. Even knowing what was coming, it was so unexpected to see three Jet Li faces coming out of the crystal water like that at first. Did he need three dragon faces and Jet Li heads? I would have been cool if he had one, if he was just one cool looking Smaug type of dragon. Like, feel like it's a little overboard because, like, the other monsters and creatures that he transforms into are like lion bears or like things, you know, they seem like mythical creatures also, but they're nowhere near this size. And I understand he's got the, you know, juice of life coursing through him at this point, but like, I was a little overwhelmed by the extra two heads on this dragon.
I can't say it bothered me, but yeah, I mean, it is the coolest monster that he turns into, right? The others are a little bit lackluster by comparison. Maybe they just wanted to come out of the gate with something really impressive.
Hey, look, it's still better than the Scorpion King.
That's true. In dragon form, he grabs Lin and Yang jumps on and hangs on for dear life. They make their way back to the tomb where his terracotta army are waiting for him. So he's got to resurrect them. Rick and everybody else all pile back into Mad Dog's plane and pursue him that way.
Everybody's, you know, back to full health. They're all geared up and ready for the final battle.
And here's where we learn a new rule, another rule for the magic of the movie. I think Michelle Yeoh's character mentions that the Terracotta Army won't become invincible until they cross the Great Wall.
That makes sense because, like, we've connected them to the Great Wall in the opening sequence. But that kind of feels like information we should have had. Like, not even us, but like Brendan Fraser, where she's like, we can't let him leave Shangri-La or else this, that, and the other thing. She's like, oh, by the way.
I do feel like that information could have been introduced a little earlier, but at the same time, I do kind of like that in this movie, the O'Connells are way out of their element and are relying on the Chinese to relay this information. You know what I mean? Like, they're not experts on Chinese history. And so I love that, like, you know, Michelle Yeoh gets the opportunity to introduce this new thing.
They were barely up with the history of Egypt. You know, I just felt like they were treasure hunters, more or less. I mean, maybe Evie, she was more of the scholar,
yes.
But Rick didn't really know, like, heads from tails or anything like that. However, I do feel like, you know, they're just rusty. They're not up on it yet. It's sinking in for them. You can see it, like, especially Brendan Fraser. There's something I love about his performance in this one, maybe because he has more of a backseat, that every time he's on screen, he's kind of trying to, like, make the most of it in a way. I don't know if that's true, but, like, that's the way it's coming across.
He could do this in his sleep too. So he definitely feels comfortable in this role.
Oh man, it would have been so funny if there was a shot of him sleeping in this movie, like having a bad dream, going like, mummies, 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 and like wakes himself up. I would have loved that. That's the kind of humor, Dan.
Yes. Okay, so the Terracotta Army won't become invincible until after they cross the Great Wall. And the plan, Ziwen's plan, is to fight back using the spirits of the defeated soldiers that are buried underneath the Great Wall.
That is awesome, where she's basically like, we're going to summon your daddy and his army, and they're going to be zombies, but they're also going to fight for us. So
this is like some straight Lord of the Rings, Return of the King shit.
But it's also cool horror stuff. Like, we're getting some horror iconography here with this zombie army.
Not to mention Ray Harryhausen.
Yeah.
Anytime you got fighting skeletons, you got my attention.
Whereas Jet Li, or I should say Dragon Emperor, as Terracotta Man, as Clayface throughout the movie, right? Like, it's not that it's scary, but it's freaky. Like, when he peels his face off and has to grow it back, like, it's bizarre. Okay, but I'm never like kind of scared, you know, but like, or, and I'm not necessarily scared now, but like, at least I'm getting some imagery that reminds me of horror movies, you know?
Yeah.
And so, like, I was kind of missing, this felt more like fantasy medieval adventure than it did based on like a horror or something.
Yeah, I agree with that. And these, they're not mummies, but like these zombie soldiers, they remind me of Imhotep's mummy soldiers.
Oh, there's always a big battle of like CGI madness at the end of one of these.
Yeah, I mean, it's at the end of the day, it's still a giant battle sequence, but I love the design of these like sort of zombie soldiers here. I love the moment where Rick's trying to explain to them that they're on the same side, and they're like, you know, Rick, I don't think they speak English, but they recognize Ziwen's name. That's all they need.
That makes sense, right? It's like the thing you remember the most, right? That they say about zombies, and it's like, this guy was married to her, so it's like, all right. You know her, I'm down with you.
The catch here is she's able to bring this army back to life in exchange for her immortality and her daughter's immortality, right? That's the price they're going to pay.
So they are human now.
Correct. So the battle begins. It's a huge battle. I mean, it's like a Lord of the Rings style battle. Looks great.
Yeah, we're pretty much in the day and age, 2008, where it's hard for this to look bad. I feel like we've got to a point where it's like, yeah, we could handle huge armies just going at it, and it's going to look fine.
I'm going to try and track a lot of this action. As always with these movies, there's like three or four different things happening all at once. So while the battle's happening, Alex sort of runs off to rescue Lin. The Emperor in his human form is fighting Ziwen.
Very cool.
Again, I'm going to echo what I said earlier. I just wish it was what I expect to see when I think of Jet Li versus Michelle Yeoh. It's not.
It would have been cool too if they did a thing where like they fought in the beginning, and then they like fight in the middle, then they fight in the end kind of thing, you know, or like at least two fights, at least a fight in the beginning and a fight at the end, sort of the revenge fight. Yeah, man, because like I wanted like a full blown sort of Shaw Brothers throwback moment here where they do crazy wire work and you see like the dust kind of come up when they hit the ground. Like I almost thought that we even throw in some of that filmmaking technique to do it.
Yeah,
camera moves, you know, and let the long shots of them just doing like 10 to 20 hits before they cut the shot, you know, so you just see rapid fire punching and kicking and all that kind of, but yeah, it's very much just kind of toned down for action adventure's sake, I guess. You know, they don't want to focus too much on anything specifically. They just want you to kind of experience the cacophony or grandeur of everything at once. everything everywhere all at once.
Ziyuan manages to stab the Emperor with this mystical dagger, but not in the heart. So she fails in that, and she ultimately is mortally wounded in this fight. We will learn that shortly. Mad Dog McGuire and Jonathan arrive by plane. And so now we've got fighting happening on the ground, fighting happening from the sky. The Emperor turns into like another beast. What you called it, like a lion bear?
It looks a little like a Pokemon. I don't mean that necessarily like disparagingly, sure. But like I'm just trying to like it's like a Wuzzle. It's hard to tell like exactly what he is, but he's like a freaky animal man now.
Yeah, he's like a big four-legged beast of some kind.
It's not quite a Foo Dog, which would have been cool.
Ziyuan ultimately dies from her wound, and now it's up to Rick and Alex to defeat the Emperor. Rick does manage to stab the Emperor, also misses his heart. The Emperor manages to break the dagger, so now it's in two pieces.
Oh, yeah. This is cool, though. I love this.
Let's see. Yang gets caught in like a giant wheel thing.
That's right. Doesn't he get crushed to death?
Yeah. They both kind of get caught in that giant gears and crushed to death.
The sprockets.
Rick, of course, is relying on his fists to fight this Emperor. And then something that Rick said earlier in the battle, you know, when they separate, they talk divide and conquer. They find the two pieces of the dagger, and divide and conquer comes back into play as they each take a piece. I think Rick stabs from the front and Alex stabs from the back.
Yeah, and the dagger fuses together inside of the mummy. Dude, that was cool. I thought that was really smart. I dug that a lot. Like, but the one thing is this Dragon Emperor, like for Jet Li, man, he's leaving himself wide open.
Yep.
Wide open. You just fought Michelle Yeoh and like you're getting taken out by the O'Connells? I don't think so. But nevertheless, I like that really cool fusing the blade inside of his body.
Yeah. And I did love this moment as, you know, as a visual representation of this father and son dynamic kind of being repaired.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that's what I was supposed to get when he brings his dad back to life in the water of eternity or whatever they bathe them in. I thought it was going to be like, you know, dad, I saved your life because like I realized how much I appreciate you kind of thing.
You're right.
You know, everything you've done, I didn't want you to die kind of thing. But this is also symbolic.
That's the climax of this battle scene. All the bad guys die. All the good guys live, yeah. Except for Michelle Yeoh.
The bad guys, literally, they get dusted.
Yeah, pretty cool. This one gets like an epilogue, which I don't remember the previous two having like an epilogue like this. They usually just ride off into the sunset. And
they're actually pretty hard outs for these types of movies, those last ones. It's just like, we did it, it's over.
This one gets a little bit of an epilogue. They're back at the nightclub. Everyone is paired off. Rick and Evie are dancing together, and Lynn and Alex are together. They, for some reason, are together as a couple.
Maybe they'll go retire in Shangri-La one day, now that they know where that is. There's nothing to protect anymore now that the Dragon Emperor is gone, right? So she's free. Hopefully she won't age 1,000 years in a day now that like whatever curses might be lifted. Right. I wish them luck.
Yeah, the whole movie she's kind of like resisting this attraction because she's gonna live forever, but now that she's mortal again, I guess she's willing to take the chance on Alex O'Connell, who is many hundreds of years younger than she is.
But also, like, what other guy does she know,
right? That's fair.
What is this dating life like that you speak of? I know not your weird future ways. Like, I'll just stick with this guy.
I do love the sort of button on the end of the movie, though, where Jonathan escaped. He's like, he's out of here. He's got the giant blue diamond, and he's like, I'm going to go someplace where there are no mummies. And he's like, I'm going to Peru. And then the little, like, message at the end, soon after, mummies were found in Peru.
Insane. And, like, wasn't the plans for Mummy 4, like, Aztec mummies or something like that? It was going to be South American, I believe. So, like, this was kind of a joke, but also maybe like we're gonna see mummies in Peru one day. That movie's gonna happen. It felt like such an afterthought to do that joke, but that is the best joke in the movie. That was like more of that kind of stuff. That felt almost like a Simpsons joke or something.
Very much so. And for whatever reason, it worked for me in ways that like other Jonathan jokes didn't. Like, I laughed out loud because you know what's gonna happen as soon as he says, I'm going where there there are no mummies, I'm going to Peru. I just love that the movie confirms it.
That's such a great way to end this movie. It's such a good laugh. That's a joke you can count on. People are kind of tired, they're exhausted, they're getting ready to leave, and the last thing I was expecting, even though I've seen this movie before, apparently blocked it from my memory, that came up and I laughed too. So job well done, Mummy 3.
All right, so that is the end of Mummy, the Tomb of the Dragon Emperor. Do you have any closing thoughts?
Definitely liked it way more this time than I did Mike from 2017. This is way better than I was remembering. I'll watch this one again, like, no problem. You know, I throw this on. There's a lot of cool imagery. There's a lot of fun story. There's a lot of fun stuff going on. You know, it's the Mummy. It's what you come to expect, and yet it's not, right? It's like, it's familiar, and it's new enough. You know, it had the right intentions and directions to where it wanted to go and wanted to be. It just didn't really get there all the way. I said a couple of times, you know, I feel like it kind of peters out or falls apart a little, or doesn't really, it loses its cohesion as it goes along. But there's still a lot of really good stuff here. I feel like the critic score might be pretty low as well as the public score on this. Like, I don't know if this is a very well-liked movie at all, but like, I will go out and say, like, I think I like this one more than Van Helsing. Like, I think I've said all this, so I'm just repeating myself, but I think I'd rewatch this before Mummy 2. So like, yeah, there's a lot going on here that's worthwhile.
Coming into this, I really thought I was going to be more negative than I ended up being. Talking to you about it, I think I enjoy it more than I did, because I watched this a couple times. I think I enjoy it more now thinking about it. You know, I still have issues with it. I'm still not sold on Maria Bello as Evie.
That might be the one big thing between us in this, is that like, I really enjoyed her energy in the movie, even though I like the previous Evie more because we had her twice. I guess I'm more used to her, but like, I didn't mind it as much as I think you did this time around.
For sure. And like I said, it could very well be a me problem. I'm curious to know if anybody else feels similarly. I think ultimately this movie is a little too familiar. It's a little too by the numbers. Mm-hmm. And I think it's overly simplified in places where I don't think it should have been overly simplified, right? I think they expanded on things that I don't think we needed, like the whole Himalaya trek up the mountain instead of just getting to Shangri-La, right? But then there are things that I wish there were more of, like more stuff with Jet Li, more stuff with Michelle Yeoh, more of the Chinese mythology. It's not as balanced as I would like, but it does sort of check a lot of the boxes for me as far as what I want out of a Mummy movie. I'm of two minds with it. And I think, yeah. I think I agree with you that I would probably watch this again before Van Helsing, because Van Helsing is just such an assault of the senses.
Right.
I can watch this and maybe I don't love it, but it's a comfort movie. Yeah, largely it does deliver on the things that I do want from a Mummy movie. So
cool.
If I speak anymore, I'm probably going to keep repeating myself. So I'm just going to leave it at that. Definitely want to hear what other people think.
Yeah.
Do people hate this one? I think a lot of people probably do hate this one, but maybe haven't watched it recently. This is one of those movies that if you rewatch it now, after not having seen it for like many years, like you, Mike, you might be surprised.
Even when this came out, I think most of the audience had moved on already to other things, to different aesthetics. I'm not saying that like this is a great movie, you know, I'm just talking about like I enjoy it, right? Like I recognize that it's got tons of flaws, okay, but I'm just trying to focus on things that I liked about it. And you know, I talked about things I didn't, you know, it's not like I left that stuff out. There's definitely some shoddy things also happening, mostly story-wise for me. So I understand if people are like, oh, that's not a good movie, you could say that probably about this, but like I still like it. You know, I like it well enough that I think it provides a nice, fun escape and just a cool, weird adventure.
Expectations also play a part. You know, I think I came into it with high expectations and that was part of it. I've already mentioned Bond a couple times tonight, but you know, like there's 25 of them. They're not all winners. I'll put on Octopussy. It's not great. I get enjoyment out of it. So, I mean, it's the third movie in a trilogy. It kind of feels like it, and that's okay. You know, yeah. I think that's ultimately where I'm going to land on this. So, okay. Well, I think that wraps us up for this episode, but we will be coming back Friday, April 26th, for more sword and sorcery action as we discuss The Scorpion King 2, Rise of a Warrior.
All right.
So we're done with the Mummy, but we still have plenty of Scorpion King left.
Yeah, we're in the Mummy verse. We're still there. And this is, okay, so follow us on this. So we had the Mummy Returns and then the Scorpion King, which was a prequel to that. And yep. Now this is a prequel to the Scorpion King.
That's correct.
We're going back double tap.
You can follow us on X, aka Twitter, at Monster Made Pod. We're also on Blue Sky at Monster Made Pod, and on Instagram and Facebook at The Monsters That Made Us. You can follow me pretty much everywhere at Dan Colon. Mike, where can listeners find you?
You can follow me pretty much everywhere at @_Mikester. That's STIR. And all the other shows I am on over at cageclub.me.
If you enjoyed this episode and you want to support the show, you can become a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/themonstersthatmadeus. You can also support the show by giving us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes. And we can't forget about our t-shirts on TeePublic. You can find the link for that in our aforementioned Twitter and Instagram bios. For all other things Cage Club related, just head on over to cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me. Stay spooky, everybody.